speak to you if I could.
Good morning, members. Call this meeting of the Commerce Committee to order. First order of business is the approval of the minutes. Representative Perryman, or Co-Chair Perryman, have you read the minutes?
I have, Chair. I've read the minutes, and I move to approve them.
Okay, thank you. Any corrections, comments? If not, vote to approve the minutes. All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Okay, we have minutes. Okay, first bill we're hearing today is House File 1646. Representative Ryer, would you like to, you're a member of this committee, aren't you?
Yeah,
yes, of course you are. Yeah, would you like to move your bill?
Yes, Mr. Chair, I move House File 1646 to be laid over.
Thank you. Would you like to present your bill?
Thank you, Mr. Chair, Chair O'Driscoll, Chair Herr, and committee members. The healthcare system in our country is expensive. High insurance premiums, high deductibles, and high prices for care. The risk for the average person to go into debt just for getting sick is unacceptably high. We need to change the system in many ways to get at the root causes of medical debt. And in the meantime, we must help the many people who are currently struggling under this burden. That's why I'm bringing forward House File 1646, the Minnesota Medical Debt Reset Act, working with undue medical debt and our Minnesota hospitals to buy down hospital debt. In a few moments, you'll hear more about why this is needed, how it's been implemented in St. Paul, and how it has changed one person's life. But first, I'll tell you more about our proposed partner in this work. Undue medical debt, formerly RIP Medical Debt, is a national 501c3 nonprofit founded in 2014. Its stated purpose is to strengthen communities by erasing financially burdensome medical debt. Undue medical debt's model allows governments to take available funding and turn it into direct relief for community members by purchasing bundled, uncollected medical debt directly from hospitals and eliminating it at a fraction of its face value. This approach means that a relatively modest public investment can abolish millions in debt. Undue has government partnerships in 25 cities, counties, and states, including Arizona, Illinois, Michigan, and New Jersey. To date, Undue's government initiatives have abolished almost $4.5 billion in medical debt for more than 3.5 million people. This bill gives us the opportunity to help the people of Minnesota. And now I'd like to turn it over to our testifiers to bring more depth to the value that this program can bring. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you, Representative Ryer. We have the Attorney General, who's running a little bit late, so the next testifier is Casey Weidrick.
Yes. Good morning, Chair Herr, Chair Driscoll, and committee members. I'm Casey Weidrick, the Financial Capability Manager for the City of St. Paul's Office of Financial Empowerment, and I manage the city's Medical Debt Reset Initiative and partnership with Undue Medical Debt, in which the city has committed $1.1 million to relieve an estimated $110 million of medical debt for St. Paul residents. In our work with Undue Medical Debt, we have abolished almost $37 million of medical debt from Fairview Health Services for just over 32,000 St. Paul residents. The debt canceled represents an average of $1,130 per resident, with the largest amount being over $272,000 abolished for a single person. Eligible residents didn't have to fill out a lengthy application that had to be reviewed by staff, but were notified by mail when their debt was relieved. A number of residents shared what it meant to them to learn they no longer owe this debt. Like Anissa, who shared, "I'm a single mother of five children, and this program has definitely relieved some stress and anxiety from my life. The program covered a medical debt of mine from about 10 years ago that I was not able to afford to pay off. I am above and beyond appreciative for this debt relief." Residents like SH shared how the cost of care and their debt has also been a barrier to getting the care that they need. "I was in two accidents and had surgeries back to back over the last 4 years. I could not afford to pay due to limited income and high rent. I could not afford to keep doctor's appointments nor my specialist appointments." The city and Undue Medical Debt are still working to cancel the debt of additional St. Paul residents, but I also get calls from outside of the city from Minnesotans looking for help with the medical debt that they didn't choose to take on and are struggling to pay. Thank you for your consideration of House File 1646 to expand this debt relief to all of Minnesota, Together, our efforts would eliminate a barrier to health care, period. Please join us in keeping our communities healthy. Thank you.
Thank you. Next testifier is Jen Schultz.
Good morning, Mr. Chair, Chairs Herr and Chair O'Driscoll, and committee. My name is Jen Schultz, and I live in St. Paul. I am a volunteer with the American Cancer Society Cancer Action Network, and I am also a four-time cancer survivor. I was first diagnosed with melanoma in 2015, and earlier this year I celebrated 3 years cancer-free. But despite being 3 years into survivorship, the financial burden remains and continues to grow. Whether you're a cancer patient or survivor, the costs associated with ongoing care add up quickly. Oncology appointments, scans, biopsies, ultrasounds, medication, treatment, and so on. The burden of medical debt doesn't just impact us, but affects our families and sometimes our friends too, making us feel like we're the burden. I often feel dependent on others and have had to ask for financial support more than once. There are weeks when I still have to choose between filling my gas tank, buying groceries, and making a full payment towards my medical bills. I am afraid to go to my mailbox because it seems that I accrue 2 to 3 more bills every time I actually manage to pay one off. And I want to add that through this entire time, I have been fully insured. A survey of cancer patients and survivors done by the American Cancer Society Cancer Action Network found 98% of respondents were insured at the time when their medical debt was incurred. Last November, I was one of the St. Paul residents that received a letter in the mail, so it was a good mail day, from the city of St. Paul showing that a portion of my medical debt had been erased. I am so grateful. It was a huge weight lifted, and I really can't find the words to express how much that meant to me. And that is why I am really excited to share my support for this bill, which would do the same thing for eligible Minnesotans across the state. The legislature has an opportunity to provide real support for Minnesotans' patients, survivors, and their families. Compared to our state budget, this small investment can lead to big relief for hundreds of thousands of Minnesotans. Nobody chooses to get sick and fall into medical debt. I didn't choose to have cancer 4 times, and medical debt should not be a lifelong side effect of a cancer diagnosis. So I'm asking today to please include HF 1646 in the final Commerce Omnibus Bill. Thank you for your time.
Thank you. I see that Attorney General Ellison has arrived. Would you like to? A.G. Ellison, thank you for attending.
Mr. Chairman, thank you, and let me thank all members for hearing this important piece of legislation. And let me say thank Chair Herr as well. Medical debt is debt that no one asked for, no one applied for, no one wanted. People don't go looking for medical debt. It's not like buying a flat screen television or any sort of consumer item. It's really something that happens to you. We can all agree that everyone should pay their bills. I certainly believe that is critically important. And Minnesotans want to do so, and they do so. But we can also agree that no one should ever have to choose between affording their lives and affording to live. Our debt systems can punish people for getting sick, forcing them further into debt just so they can afford the essentials of their families. Last year, Minnesota passed the Debt Fairness Act. This is a dramatic and important step forward, and I commend the legislature for passing this great legislation, especially this bill author, Liz Ryer. Thank you very much. And last year, the Debt Fairness Act means, because of your action, that no Minnesotan will be saddled with a spouse's medical debt after their spouse has passed. No Minnesotan will be denied medical treatment because of old hospital bills. No Minnesotan will see their credit wrecked by medical debt because medical debt can no longer be reported to credit agencies. But there's still much work to do. Still much work to do because many Minnesotans who carry medical debt, they just cannot pay back. And it eats away at their ability to afford their lives and to contribute to our society. This bill would not only be a victory for struggling Minnesotans who didn't ask to get sick or for the debt that came along with it, it would also be a big victory for hospitals, helping them fulfill their commitment to community well-being while also getting debt off their balance sheets that might not recover otherwise. And it would be a victory for every community in Minnesota, because when one of us can get the necessary medical care we need, all of us are healthier. So thank you. That's what I want to present to you today. And if there's any questions, I'll be available.
Great. Thank you. Good. We have one more testifier, Dr. Angelica Willis.
Co-Chair O'Driscoll, Co-Chair Herr, and members of the House Commerce, Finance, and Policy Committee. My name is Angelica Willis, and I'm a physician representing Minnesota Doctors for Health Equity. I'm asking you to support HF 1646, the Medical Debt Reset Act. I feel compelled to speak today because I have seen my patients suffer from the effects of medical debt. Medical debt is one of the leading causes of personal bankruptcy in the U.S., and more than half of Americans have been forced to carry some degree of medical debt within the past 5 years. Medical debt puts Minnesotans in impossible situations. Several older adult patients of mine resorted to eating dog or cat food mixed with water because they could not afford food, their home, their medications, and their medical debt payments. This should be profoundly disturbing to all of us. It also resulted in additional healthcare system expenses when each of those seniors was hospitalized for weight loss and for life-threatening electrolyte abnormalities. I have also seen patients hospitalized for preventable or treatable conditions that escalated to lifelong illnesses, disability, or death because they were simply afraid to seek medical care earlier due to fear of medical costs or adding to their medical debt. The fear of medical debt affects our relationships with our patients and can make patients delay or defer basic treatments that they need to be healthy. HF 1646 is not a cure-all, but it can help to forgive the debt of an estimated 250,000 to 400,000 Minnesotans, giving them a chance to restore their health and their financial well-being. For the impacted Minnesotans, this could be life-changing. Thank you, Co-Chair O'Driscoll and Co-Chair Herr, for the opportunity to testify today. Your consideration and support of HF 1646 is incredibly important to patients and providers across Minnesota. I would be happy to respond to your questions.
Great. Thank you. Members, discussion. I think Representative Finke. Are there any members of the public that wish to testify? No. Okay. We're good for discussion. Representative Finke.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you, Representative Ryer, for bringing this bill. I represent St. Paul. The program in St. Paul where we spent $1 million and we relieved $100 million in medical debt is one of the things that I hear the most about residents from residents of St. Paul. And I just want to make sure, but this bill, as I understand it, is not going to move today. This is a bill that allows the state to spend $5 million to relieve $500 million in medical debt from Minnesotans. The return on investment for this $5 million, what we have listened to all session long about the burdens of medical insurance and medical care and the cost of it, it's, I don't know why we're not doing this, but I think it is outrageously immoral for us not to find a way to get that 100 times return on the money that we could spend to help Minnesotans. Minnesotans are buried in medical debt. We could help so many people, literally change their lives by unburdening them from $500 million of debt, and we're just not going to. Do you know why, Representative Breyer? Like, what, or anybody, any of the testifiers, why are we not going to do this?
Representative Breyer, sorry.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mm-hmm. Representative Finke. Well, some of it, that's such a big question. There's timing, but to me, the bill is not done. We're going into conference. It's live in the Senate. So to me, I'm not here because I want to do informational and say, well, better luck next time. I'm here because I still see a pathway. Also, I'd like to add that the amount in the bill is $5 million, and I'm sure people will ask this, so I'll anticipate it's scalable. So if what we can do is $5 million, great. And if what we can do is something else, we will do what we can.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, Representative Pinky, a follow-up?
Thank you. I am aware that the bill is still alive. I don't mean to imply that we are, that this bill can't move forward. I just want to make sure that we as a body in the House recognize that this is something that we didn't include this. And I just want that to be extremely clear because the benefits of this are just preposterously obvious. And it has worked very well in St. Paul. So thank you for bringing it. I would urge all of us not to oppose the unburdening of our communities from debt. Thanks.
Thank you. Representative Smith and then Representative Dotseth after that.
Thank you, Chair. Thank you, Representative Breyer, for bringing this. I am I'm a proud co-author with you on this legislation and hope we can get something done. The term, the concept of medical debt is something that we should all be ashamed exists in our society. I come from a community that is incredibly proud that we are leading the way in research and care for diseases of all kinds. And I have never talked to a doctor, a researcher, a nurse, a surgeon who says, I got into this to treat people only who can pay for the care that we have here at this hospital, clinic, whatever it might be. We have advanced so far, and we should be so proud of that. However, we can now treat people with diseases we're not in control of, like melanoma or kidney disease or fill in the blank. But to be treated, they now have a lifetime sickness of economic debt that will drag them down for the rest of their lives. Maybe because they didn't have enough money at the start, maybe because their insurance company found a way to not pay certain claims, whatever the reason. This is another bill of a parade of bills we have seen that shows that our access to health care in this state and in this country is fundamentally broken, and we need to fix it. This is one fix to help people who are miring in debt right now, but we also need to get to the root of the cause, which is the inaccessibility of medical care and the decision that we have made that it is based on how much someone has, their net worth, whether they can get care, whether they can pay for that care that they get. So thank you, Representative Ryer, for this bill, and let's work on this committee to continue to make this space better.
Thank you. Representative Dotseth and then Representative Gatiza-Watoon.
Thank you, Chair, Representative Ryer, and the testifiers. I thank you for coming and testifying today. It's always difficult to come and share your story, so I thank you for doing that. Question I would have is, with that $5 million ask, what guardrails do we have in place with the money that go into the nonprofits to make sure it's truly being distributed to Minnesota's healthcare, so it's actually going towards our medical debt?
Representative Ryer.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Dotseth. Yeah, I take that very seriously, that the money is used with integrity. In looking at Undo Medical Debt, they are a longstanding organization with a good track record, good ratings from the various organizations I've looked at in preparing for this session. Also, their 990s display how they use the funds. I would like to also point out we do have a representative Undo Medical Debt on Zoom who could speak to that more fully if you would like that.
I would, please. Thank you.
It's Courtney. Courtney Story is willing to answer that question online. Ms. Story, can we hear you? You've got yourself on mute. There we go.
Can everyone hear me now?
Yes.
Okay, just perfect. Good morning, everybody. Thank you for having me. Courtney Story, Vice President of Government Initiatives at Undo Medical Debt. I would just like to say we have government contracts at state, local, and county levels across the country. We are now in 25 different jurisdictions. We take our work very seriously. We're working in St. Paul. We work with a financial company to ensure that all relief is only targeted to folks who are currently living in Minnesota. So once we buy a file from a hospital, we take everything that's in that file and we verify folks' income and residence to ensure that the relief that is paid for by Minnesota is only going to those who are current Minnesota residents.
Representative Dotson, did that answer your question?
It does. Thank you, Representative, for the clarity on that. Thank you.
Yeah. Thank you, Ms. Story. Representative Katiza Watoon.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you, Representative Breyer, for bringing this bill forward, and thank you, Attorney General Ellison, for being a partner on this. The return on this investment is almost mind-boggling. And you know, just a little bit of back-of-the-napkin math that I was doing over here. I serve right now as the co-chair of the Children and Families Committee, and we're making an investment in early learning scholarships in Minnesota, which research backs me up, and I will say that one of the absolute best places, if not the best place that we can spend our money, is investing in our littlest Minnesotans. But $5 million of scholarship money helps 333 children earn scholarships for 1 year. $5 million in this bill relieves roughly 250,000 to 400,000 Minnesotans of their medical debt. And you know what, Representative Ryer, I'm willing to bet that a couple of those parents, a couple of those patients are parents or want to be parents. And relieving this debt allows them to better afford the cost of childcare here in Minnesota. I spoke with a constituent on the doors in October. He said that because of the Debt Fairness Act, Minnesota is the only state that he and his partner will consider living in long term because she has past medical history and medical debt. And it's the only place that they can get married without him becoming indebted to the medical system because of the cost of her care. This bill is a no-brainer. And I really hope that comes back to us down the line. Thank you for your work on this.
Representative Ryer? Mm-hmm. Okay.
It's fine.
You're fine? Okay. Representative Hewitt and then Representative Van Vinsberg.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And this bill does hit home. People would not get in my ambulance because of the medical debt they had. They wanted us to treat them on scene, and they really needed to go to the hospital. A story with a constituent recently in the last door knock was a former CEO of a neighboring state. Multi-million dollars were in his account. And his wife, unfortunately, was diagnosed with a real rare form of cancer. And he said that there was nothing I wasn't going to do to help her or try to cure her or give her more days. He was living in public housing. He lost everything he had. He's living off his Social Security. This has no barriers or where it goes, because what is the price of a life? And people will do everything they can to keep their loved ones with us. So I've seen it, I've experienced it, and I think, Representative Ryer, you're hitting the target exactly where it is, and I hope that this stays alive, because there's so many, because when this bill is not paid, we pay it anyways. We healthcare workers pay it because they're not going to get the raises because the hospitals have to write this off. Most of this hits doctors and their clinics, and they have to write it off. And then we wonder why people aren't going into healthcare anymore. And it's not that it's like Representative Smith said, they didn't get in this to find out how much money they can collect. They got in this because they really have a calling towards that. And so we really got to, I mean, this is a really good program. And Representative Ryer, like I said, it's a great bill. This is more of a statement, but thank you for bringing it.
Good. Okay. Representative Van Vinsbergen.
Thank you, Representative. Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you, Representative Ryer. I guess my question is kind of twofold. And kind of going back to Representative Dotsa's comments, I'm curious about undues, how they take files in accounts. How's that determined? Do they buy them one by one? Do they buy bulk? And so I'd just like to understand the determination of that process. And then the other question is, you know, the nonprofit undue, based out of Massachusetts, I'm curious, you know, how do they charge? And, you know, what are their costs for doing business?
Mm-hmm. Representative Ryer.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, Representative. Mm-hmm. Again, I think that our testifier on Zoom would be the best person to take these.
Ms. Story, if you're still there, yep, she's coming off mute.
Yes, good morning. Happy to address those questions. So we are based in New York, actually, but we work nationwide. We are happy to provide an overview of our pricing and how our budgeting models work. We take a 15% indirect cost rate, and that is what we charge for our overhead and admin. The rest of the money goes directly towards debt abolishment. I do want to be very clear that there are costs associated with debt abolishment that are outside of the purchase price of the file. So those costs include things like mailing letters and running those financial qualifications and residential qualifications that I talked about before. But I'm happy to provide the committee with a full overview of how our financial budgeting and everything is set up. We are very transparent. Our invoices are very transparent. You will be able to see exactly how every dollar is spent. How we work with providers, we purchase files directly from hospitals and hospital systems. We also purchase files from the secondary market. The secondary market are those debt collectors. Those are the folks that are typically more aggressive in reaching out to patients, trying to get them on payment plans. That those are debt files that have already been sold from hospitals. So they're typically a little bit older. So we purchase debt from the secondary market as well. We also purchase debt from physician groups, from anesthesiology groups. We are very open. It is really who wants to work with us and who wants to sell us their bad debt. We are open to working with any and everyone to make those purchases. So happy to clarify any further or address any additional questions.
Representative Van Rensburgen, your question is answered.
One other follow-up question. You know, can you explain the cost to purchase the files? Give a little more detail to that.
Ms. Story?
Yeah, absolutely. That is just the direct price that we pay to the provider for the file. We follow the same pricing model as a secondary collector, so we're paying the same price that a secondary collector would pay for the debt if they were to purchase that. So that is our sort of pitch to the hospital. Sell it to us and we'll abolish it. You'll get the same amount of money instead of selling it to a secondary collector who may then try to go after folks and collect on that debt. Mm-hmm.
Representative Van Vinsbergen? You good?
No further questions.
Good. Representative Ryer? No?
Thank you, Mr. Chair, committee. Yeah. I appreciate the questions.
Well, we have one more question, I'm sorry. Representative Cha.
Thank you, Chair. And thank you, Representative Rye, for bringing this forward. I heard another comment about how this affects credit scores, and, you know, that's important, right? That's important to a lot of seniors and a lot of people who are in this position where they need care, and they're thinking about, you know, how this may affect their families, their future, and their livelihood. Also, I want to share that I've seen seniors and their fear of the debt, the medical debt, right? The fear that a senior has. And I've seen senior citizens refuse to receive care, even to call an ambulance, because of the fear of the debt, of the medical debt. And I just want to say that I've seen that they fear the medical debt more than death itself. And that's something to be said. So thank you for bringing this bill forward, Ryer, and I hope we can move on it. Thanks.
Okay, thank you. So we will be laying this bill over. If there are no further questions, Representative Ryer, would you like to wrap up?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you, everyone. I appreciate the questions, especially those that are helping make it more clear how the program works. In all of the work that I've done, I have seen no complaints about how it's been administered. I've heard no concerns from other states or municipalities. And so, I am confident that that would have surfaced in my investigation. I think it's very important. People have this debt, and even if the hospital writes it off, people don't know that that debt's been written off. So it's still hanging over them, causing stress, anxiety, the health issues that go with that, and the denial of care, and the seniors, and the young parents who are like, do we have to go in for this maybe ear infection, because they are afraid of accruing more debt. So I think it's a great program. I would love to see us invest in Minnesotans, and I appreciate your consideration.
Thank you. And with that, this bill, House File 1646, is laid over. And I can't remember if I announced that there was a quorum present at the beginning, but for the record, we do have a quorum present. We'll now hear from our agencies to present the governor's budget. First is Grace Arnold, Commissioner of the Minnesota Department of Commerce. Welcome, Commissioner Arnold.
Thank you.
And Mr. Smith.
I'll give Sam a moment to get us set up. We have a few slides.
Progress. There we go.
All right, great. I'm happy to be here. So good morning, Chair Herr and O'Driscoll, Acting Chair Elkins, and members. For the record, I'm Grace Arnold. I'm the Commissioner of the Minnesota Department of Commerce, and I'm really here, excited to be here to present the governor's budget. I'm with Sam Smith, who's our Director of Government Affairs, and I won't take it too long of a time. We'll go into each of these, but happy to take any questions. So we have an operating increase, which is, so this is the overview of the governor's budget. We have an operating increase, which is a general fund item, but all the other proposals you hear are cost neutral. So flagging that there's only one that's a general fund item. So let me just go into the details of the proposals briefly. So the first is our operating increase. Like most state agencies, we have an operating increase request. It's a general fund request of just over $3 million. With $1.162 million in fiscal year 2026 and $1.84 in the subsequent years. These funds will go toward operating pressures like in multiple categories. So that's increases in compensation, insurance costs, increases to maintain our current staff, and then in a challenging labor market, and increasing IT costs. Thank you for including the full operating adjustment in the House position, which I think we'll hear later. That we've seen significant growth across all the industries we regulate, which is really great for the Minnesota economy, but does put pressure on our teams. And so this is an essential investment in the department that will ensure that consumers and businesses we regulate can continue to rely on high quality service and support. The next item in the governor's budget is the reinsurance or premium security plan. Reinsurance has a proven program that stabilizes individual market premiums, maintains enrollment levels, and ensures that consumers have meaningful choices in the individual health insurance market. Reinsurance works, but funding has been a challenge. Following the lead of other states, we propose instituting an assessment to ensure that there's stable funding for the reinsurance program. Without this action, the premium security plan will be depleted, and Minnesotans on the individual market are at significant risk of premium increases of 25% or more on the individual market. That means that people will lose coverage, fewer Minnesotans will receive primary care, and more people will rely on expensive treatment in emergency situations. The next item, again, it's a cost-neutral item, is security staffing needs. Securities. The Department of Commerce has made significant process and technology improvements to support our securities staff as they support the finance industry and manage securities risks in Minnesota. Despite these efforts, our current team of two examiners and two registration analysts cannot adequately support the large number of investment advisor representatives, broker-dealers, and agents that are registered in Minnesota. Our staff ratios are not comparable with other states. For example, Wisconsin oversees a market on the same scale to Minnesota, and they have three times as many examiners as we do currently. We're proposing to increase transfer fees and exempt reporting advisor fees, not all license fees. Charging a nominal fee on a narrowly focused activity will allow the department to provide additional and significant resources to the entire population. So thank you for including this in the House position. The next I'll talk about is electric vehicle supply equipment testing. So as more Minnesotans are driving electric vehicles, we must ensure that consumers are getting what they pay for mobile charging stations. According to the U.S. Department of Energy, there are 2,276 charging ports across 862 stations in Minnesota. While there's an effort by the electric vehicle supply equipment charger producers to develop uniform standards, there's currently no regulatory oversight of this industry in Minnesota. So we're proposing to authorize Commerce's Weights and Measures Unit to test and inspect electric vehicle charging stations and funding staff necessary to do this work on a routine basis through a fee of $100 per charging port collected from businesses that are undergoing the inspection. We have not heard any opposition to this proposal and would urge the House to consider adopting this position in the eventual conference committee. We screamed through it.
Thank you very
much.
Happy
to take any questions.
Yes, member questions. Not seeing any member questions, you get off easy this morning.
All right. Thank you so much.
Okay, next we have Eric Tobel, Interim Director of the Office of Cannabis Management. Mr. Tobel.
Good morning, Chair. Chair Driscoll, Chair Herr. My name is Eric Tobel. I'm the Interim Director for the Office of Cannabis Management. And I'm happy to come today and talk a little bit about the proposals the office made for inclusion in the committee's budget bill. So I'll note that the OCM continues to build the foundation for a safe, well-regulated, equitable, and sustainable cannabis market, and we've identified a number of key budget pieces that we think are necessary to implement our launch, which every time I come here, the term imminent gets closer, so I'm very excited about that. As we approach these milestones, we're laser-focused on getting licenses out the door, and so most of these focus on that sort of core goal. First, similar to the Commissioner Arnold's note, we're seeking an operating adjustment that really is designed to help cover the increasing cost of things like employee compensation, insurance, rents, IT services, and other operating costs. We appreciate that these were included in the proposed bill by the committee. Mm-hmm. We're also looking to build continuity for our community reinvestment grant. The CanRenew grant is the centerpiece of House File 100's commitment to reinvest in communities that were harmed by cannabis prohibition. As I've mentioned before, when I've come here, the office has spent an incredible amount of time working to build a enterprise-leading grants program that's focused on accountability and oversight and ensuring that Minnesotan tax dollars are appropriately spent for the purposes for which they were allocated by these bodies. We've worked with the Office of Grants Management, the Office of the Legislative Auditor to ensure that the programs that we give money to are able to achieve the things that they set out to do. This request is a request to be able to expend into the next fiscal year funds for the grant recipients that we'll award shortly. We just had our first round of grant applications. We're in the process of reviewing those, and before we give any funds, we want to ensure that both the office and the grant recipient are in a place where they'll be able to deliver those funds in an appropriate way. This request is budget neutral since it just allows us to expend the funds that were already encumbered for, already provided for last year. One of the biggest challenges new markets in cannabis face is the ability to test product fast enough to get it to market shelves. This testing capacity often results because it is an onerous burden to become a licensed testing facility. One of the things we identified as an area where we can alleviate some of that burden is moving the requirement that a testing facility be licensed by ISO, the International Standards Organization for specific purposes, from a front-end requirement to an ongoing requirement so that we can allow facilities who have not yet been certified to be licensed and begin testing while they take the 18 to 24 month period that it can take to become certified. There is a one-time cost associated with this request. However, because it's one-time and it's oriented towards launch, the agency is willing to absorb the cost. Similarly, the office has identified through constituency feedback that the social equity criteria had a distinction between persons who had been convicted of a cannabis offense and those persons who had had a stay of adjudication for a cannabis offense or were adjudicated delinquent for a cannabis offense. It was our understanding and the constituency's understanding that those persons were just as justice involved as others with convictions, and allowing those persons to become social equity verified for future rounds of licensure would serve the same benefits that the legislature sought to ameliorate with the creation of the social equity criteria. Like the testing facility, there's a one-time cost associated here, but the agency can absorb that cost, and so there's no cost associated with it. Thank you, chairs, for including this language in the cannabis policy omnibus passed last week. It also is reflected in the budget sheet, so it's in the policy side over here, but in your spreadsheet about the budget, you'll note those absorbed costs in the lines related to these two items. So again, I want to thank the committee for addressing the provisions in the DE for including many of our requests. I also do want to address provisions in the DE that didn't align with the governor's recommendations. We're certainly concerned about the proposed reductions to the CanRenew Community Reinvestment Grant. As we often talk about as an office, social equity is more than just licensing. And House File 100 established the CanRenew Community Reinvestment Grants as sort of a centerpiece for how we'll reinvest in those communities that were harmed by prohibition. We've worked diligently to launch this program with accountability and equity at the center. As I noted, I think when I was here last time, we had just opened for applications for the CanRenew grants. We've now received more than, I think, 150 applications for CanRenew grants. The majority of those focus on youth activities and economic development programs. All totaled, the request would add up to $22 million. And in this first year, we only have $1 million. So we'll have a lot of work to do to sort through what we do with the small amount we have this year, but I do want to be clear that there's, substantial interest in communities that have been impacted by prohibition to have access to these funds. We look forward to continued discussion regarding the importance of these programs in the coming days, and I am willing to answer any questions that the committee may have.
Okay. Thank you, Director Tobel. Are there any member questions? Not seeing any. Director Tobel, you get off easy today, too.
I appreciate that. Thank you.
Thank you. Next bill on the agenda is House File 2443, and Chair Herr will be presenting this bill. Chair Herr, I understand you'll be moving that this bill be referred to the Committee on Ways and Means.
Yes, Chair Elkins. I move that House File 2443 be referred to the Committee on Ways and Means.
Okay. And then you have a DE1 amendment?
Yes, the DE1 amendment is, let me just double check here. It is the bill. And so, yes, I'll talk to the DE1. And what this is that this is a budget bill that was put together for the jurisdiction of the Commerce Committee. It does encompass the Department of Commerce and also the Office of Cannabis Management. Our committee was given a budget of $3 million for the next biennium and to cut $10 million in the tails. And what we did within this budget was looked at how we could fund the work that needs to happen within the department, but also how we can ensure that some of the important work that this committee has done is included in this. And so as we'll have House nonpartisan staff go over the bill, I would just highlight that we did include the task force that Representative Elkins had worked on around insurance, and also the Office of Ombudsman, which was something that I think this committee thought was important around some of the work that we've been discussing around HOAs. And so with that, I think that just that really is, we do have a pretty small budget, and it was pretty simple. And so I would just turn it over to maybe House Fiscal to go over the details of the budget.
Ms. Beckel.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. Solveig Beckel, House Fiscal. You have a spreadsheet in your packets that in the upper left-hand corner is titled Commerce, Finance, and Policy, HF2443DE1. This is the full spreadsheet for the Commerce and Office of Cannabis Management area. I won't go through the whole spreadsheet, but I'll explain it briefly. The first column is just line numbers. The second column is the program area, so you'll find the name of the item there. The third column is the fund, so if it's not a general fund, it'll say a different fund, and those funds are explained at the bottom of the spreadsheet, so page 4. Then we have the February forecast, which is the base funding, meaning that this is the funding that was in, that is in current law, so this bill will be making changes over that base funding level. The next columns are the governor's recommendations that you just heard from the department and the Office of Cannabis Management, and then the remaining columns that are titled HF2443-DE1 are the House bill as proposed today. And then you can see in the shaded columns there on the right-hand side of the spreadsheet, that is the change from base. So the first items that show a change are the overall spending. That's on lines 3 and 4. So overall spending for the Department of Commerce changed by $200,000 in fiscal year 25. And then in fiscal years 26 and 27, it increased by $5.158 million. And in fiscal years 28 and 29, it increased by $5.836 million under this bill. Line 4, spending for the Office of Cannabis Management changed overall in fiscal years 26 and 27 by a cut of $642,000 and then a reduction of $13.886 million in fiscal years 28 and 29. Moving down to the overall revenues on line 6, you can see some fee revenue for the Department of Commerce. This is for the investment advisor and broker-dealer examiners. So this is a two-part proposal on the part of the department that they explained earlier. So this is the fee revenue. This would bring in $1.47 million in each biennium. On line 7, you can see the cannabis licensing revenue that would be coming into the Office of Cannabis Management. This would be from House File 1615, the first engrossment. So this would be from the lower potency hemp edible wholesaler license that is being created in House File 1615. The first engrossment, but it is moving with this bill. So that would have revenues of $246,000 in the first biennium and $480,000 in the second biennium. You can see that the totals then on line 8 net to the targets. You add the fiscal years 24 and 25 change to the fiscal years 26 and 27 change to get $3 million above base, and then the change below base for fiscal years 28 and 29 is $10 million, so that nets to the targets. All right, then I'm just going to go to the changes, but please let me know if you have questions. Line 20, here you see the spending for the investment advisor and broker-dealer examiners. You saw the revenue earlier. This is the spending for those examiners. This is, has a cost of $1.47 million in each biennium, so it nets to zero. Line 33 is the operating adjustment for the Department of Commerce. This has a cost of $3.002 million in the first biennium and $3.68 million in the second biennium. Moving on to page two. On line 45, you can see the Homeowners Association Ombudsperson. This is from House File 856. This would have a cost of $686,000 each biennium. The next change then is on page three. Line 92, it's the Homeowners and Commercial Property Insurance Affordability Task Force. This was House File 2228. And this is actually an appropriation to the LCC, so I will make a note to update the spreadsheet, so sorry about that. This is just a one-time appropriation of $200,000 in fiscal year 25 only. That's the only change on page three, so moving on to page four. Page four shows the budget for the Office of Cannabis Management. Line 112 shows the operating adjustment. This is $842,000 in fiscal years 26 and 27 and $1.114 million in fiscal years 28 and 29. Lines 113 and 114 show the items that were absorbed that the that the office just discussed. So these are in House File 1615, the first engrossment. You can take a look at those. They're in Article 2, but they are going, they're just here in the spreadsheet to show you those numbers. Line 116 shows the CanRenew grant reductions. They are being reduced by $1.484 million in the first biennium and $15 million in the second biennium. And then lines 117 and 118 go together. This is just allowing that extension of fiscal year 25 funding into the next biennium, so canceling the $1 million and then reappropriating it with availability through the second biennium. And Mr. Chair, that is the spreadsheet.
Great, thank you. Members, are there any questions for Ms. Bacall about the fiscal analysis? If not, Ms. Pompu, would you like to walk through the House research analysis?
Sure. Chair and members, so Article 1 of the bill, Ms. Beckel just ran through, those are the appropriations to Commerce and the Office of Cannabis Management. Article 2 is miscellaneous commerce policy. The first section is the Common Interest Community Ombudsperson. That's an office that's created in the Department of Commerce. The second section is really a technical change relating to advisors and broker-dealers. The third section changes the transfer fee for broker-dealers from $25 to $65 and requires investment advisors to pay a $50 transfer fee to the Department of Commerce. Section 4 requires a private fund advisor to pay a $100 filing fee when filing an initial registration or a transfer to the Department of Commerce. And Section 5 is a task force on homeowners and commercial property insurance. This is the 2025 appropriation that Ms. Beckel talked about. And they have a report that will be due to be submitted by February 15th, 2026, and then that task force will expire.
Great, thank you. Are there any questions for Ms. Pompu? We're a quiet bunch this morning. Okay. I would move, the chair moves the A5 amendment in the package. This is a heavily negotiated provision that adds a representative to the insurance task force for the multifamily association and three additional representatives from the insurance industry to make sure that we have the full breadth of expertise we need at the table to cover, you know, reinsurance, a variety of different areas of specific expertise that we need at the table for this task force. Chair Herr?
I would encourage members to vote yes on the amendment.
Mm-hmm. Thank you. Members, any questions? Well, we're really, really a quiet group this morning. Again, repeat my motion to include the A5 amendment. All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Okay, the amendment is adopted. So, Chair Herr, would you like to renew your motion to adopt the DE amendment as amendment?
So moved, Chair.
Yep. Any discussion? If not, all those in favor say aye.
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 Opposed? Okay, the motion prevails and the DE1 amendment as amended is adopted. Testimony, yes. We heard from the department and the office earlier. There's no other people listed to testify. Are there any other members of the public wishing to testify to this bill? I see Mr. Carlson approaching the table. Would you like to identify yourself for the record, as if it was necessary?
Mr. Chairman and members, briefly, Joel Carlson, and I'm here on behalf of the law firm of Greenstein and Sellers, which is a law firm that represents homeowners and homeowner associations. I want to provide a brief comment on Article 2, Section 1 on the Ombudsman. I've been communicating with Representative Moeller. There isn't a data classification in this section, and so all the information that the Ombudsman that they would receive, whether it's contracts from management companies or other information, would be fully public, which is something she and I wanted to put on the record that needs to be worked on as this proceeds to conference. I didn't want to miss the bite at the apple to say, hey, where were you? So that's a glaring issue that needs to be corrected. Thank you.
Good catch, Mr. Carlson. Any other discussion? Are there one more person who wants to testify? Okay.
I don't move as fast as I used to.
Yeah. Tell me about it.
I'll get a little closer here. 10 years ago, I'd have been halfway to Minneapolis by now.
Yeah, so, okay.
My name is Gary Fry from Medi, Minnesota. Uh-huh. And I want to thank Representative Herr for giving me this chance to testify before the Commerce Committee. And I told her when they were talking about the cannabis bill a couple of weeks ago, I'm like, I couldn't move fast enough to get up to the microphone to testify. So I called her office, and they said, yeah. So I just want to ask you the question, and you guys might know the answer to this since you're on the Commerce Committee. What is commerce? Daniel Webster says it's merchandise or it's a market, the buying and selling of goods, especially when done on a large scale between cities, states, or counties. It's trade. And we could go in and look at commercialism, and some of you would say they have commercialized Easter too much. Look at all that candy that's going out there that Cadbury's making $20 million on. And we say that about sometimes Christmas, don't we? And commercialized, to engage in running a business mainly for profit, especially at a sacrifice of other values. And I think that's what we've done with this cannabis deal. And you received a picture there when I was a Kent State hippie, and most of you were not alive in 1971, but I can testify that I was a Kent State hippie. If you see my picture there, my eyes are bulged out. Although Bill Clinton said he didn't inhale, I did inhale, and it was to my detriment. And but I had to buy my marijuana from someone at Kent State University. And it was just as easy as going down to the Quick Trip and buying a quart of milk. I was 18 years old, and I decided that I was tired of drinking beer and drinking alcohol, and I guess they're going to get their weed. I don't know. So anyhow, I decided with all my pals there, if you see the other picture, we are protesting in the middle of the street in front of Kent State University. I don't know how they took our picture there. And I never showed it to my mother, who was born in 1923, and my dad was born in 1918. They went through the Depression, then through World War II, but never showed that picture to them. And I thought to myself, how'd they get that picture of me protesting on the street that day? And I'll guarantee you, the people who were selling marijuana at Kent State, it was definitely against the law in Ohio. I grew up in Ohio, and I moved to Minnesota in 1990, so I've been here longer, so they just call me Gary Gopher now. But they didn't give it to me. I had to take a $20 bill out and give it to them. And this man was in the weed business to make money. And I'll tell you, in my personal life, marijuana hurt my life. I had to quit college because I was stoned so much. I couldn't think straight. I'd wake up in the morning, and I think to myself, oh, I already missed my 7 o'clock class, my 8 o'clock class, and never went back to college again until I was 38 years old. But, I'm not going to take my Bible out because I already memorized this. This is the scripture that Billy Graham preached on his whole life, John 3:16. For God so loved the world that he gave his only begotten Son, that whosoever believeth in him should not perish, but have everlasting life. But the verse that we don't look at is verse 17. You don't have to worry. I'm not going to keep you past noon. Your roast won't burn. And it says, for God sent not his Son into the world to condemn the world, but that the world through him might be saved. See, God didn't send Jesus into this world to condemn us. We think, oh, those Christians, they're just going to condemn us. No, Jesus doesn't condemn us. I've been a pastor for 45 years, and I've dealt with some happy times.
Yeah, we're coming to a close here, aren't we?
Yeah, and I will close in 2 minutes. Okay. Can you give me 2 minutes? Yeah. Thank you for that. I appreciate that. And but I've been a pastor for 45 years, and I've dealt with many problems, people that had problems. And there were three main things. Most of the problems were caused by booze, marijuana, and gambling. And we have commissioners for marijuana and pay them, I don't know how much we pay them. We have commissioners for booze. We have commissioners for gambling. And I would just suggest, in these 10 days you have off, to think about it. Look at all the millions we're spending to try to get people off of booze, off of drugs, fentanyl. And I could give you a story about Lori, a lady in our church, and I'll just give you a 30-second story. She borrowed money from her grandma to go to college, but she took that money to go and gamble. And then she wrecked her car. She lost all the money. And then she had to go to grandma and explain. So I would just suggest, take 10 days, think about it. Think about what you're doing. You're ruining people's lives with this cannabis and with this marijuana, because it is way stronger than when I smoked marijuana back in 1971, 72. And so I would just suggest to think about it. Okay. And thank you for your time. I appreciate it.
Thank you for your testimony. Just for the record, in 1971, I was a member of College Republicans on the campus of the University of California at Berkeley. There were about a dozen of us.
Now that is a miracle, isn't it? Yeah. What happened? Yeah.
And I did inhale, but it didn't do anything for me, so I never took it up as a habit.
What happened, Mr. Chair? Yeah.
Mr. Chair, okay. For the record, I wasn't born yet in 79.
Yeah.
And I'm old, so. And I'm old.
Okay. So, members, are there any other comments or questions before we... Chair O'Driscoll.
Well, Representative Elkins, I learned something about you today that I did not know. Maybe we should be more concerned about the effects of Berkeley College than marijuana. I jest with my friend, Representative Elkins.
Good. Representative Herr, any final comments?
No. Well, I just want to say first thank you to my partner, Co-Chair O'Driscoll, who worked with me on this. This is my name, though my name is on this. This is equally our work, and we worked late into the weekend because we wanted to make sure that we got this right. And I appreciate the compromise and the thoughtfulness. We had some really hard conversations. I want everyone to know that we both took this very seriously, even though the budget looks quite small. There were a lot of things that we wanted to make sure that spoke to the values of what we believed in. And so I thank him for always coming and being an honest partner and working through tough issues. I want to thank the committee and all of your work. And I know that you all knew that we would have a small target, but that you still brought bill language and provisions that you thought were important to the work, and though those things did not make it into the budget, it was not because of the lack of will, but it is what the constraints that are in front of us. And so I want to thank all of the members, and I want to thank how well and cordial and thoughtful you've all been in the comments that you have made and the work that you've done here. And so I just want to say thank you to the entire committee, to our staff who put a lot of work into this. I want to just lift up Jonathan on the GOP side because he had really big committees in addition to this one. Not that Simon didn't work hard, but Jonathan had a lot on his plate. And so I just wanted to say special thank you to Jonathan for all of the hard work you put into this. And so this is a good bill, and I look forward to what we will continue to do together, but also in conference what we might be able to compromise or bring in that we might not have been able to. And so I would encourage everyone a yes vote on this bill.
Yeah. Not every committee is where we are today, so it's to the credit of both chairs that we are where we are and the civil discussions that we've had in this committee. This is I asked to be on this committee, and because I've always known it's always been a comparatively bipartisan committee where we get good work done. So thanks to all of us here, I think we've got a good bill here in front of us. So. With that, I think Chair Herr renews her motion that House File 2443 is amended, be re-referred to the Committee on Ways and Means. All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? We have a bill. House File 2443 is amended, is re-referred to the Committee on Ways and Means. And I move that nonpartisan staff be authorized to make any technical changes needed to reflect the will of the committee. All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? The motion prevails. Since today is the last regularly scheduled meeting of the Commerce Committee, I will turn it over to the co-chairs for their final comments. Representative Chair O'Driscoll, would you like to go first?
You will be receiving your summer school schedule, so hang tight. Just check to see who's still paying attention. I, again, would like to thank the Commerce Committee and co-chair her, Simon Brown, the CA, Emma, the CLA, who's not present today from our team, Karen Hartwig, who is the GOP CLA, Jonathan Cotter, our CA. We have worked together as, if you will, the kind of the administrative and leadership of this very, very well together. And this committee has 20 members on it of the 134 in the Minnesota House. We have a little over 10 to 15% of the membership of the House on this committee. And you just heard this committee today and in the time that we passed out the policy bill pretty much unanimously support the work of this committee. When Co-Chair Herr and I found out that we were going to be the chairs of this, our previous experience in working in pensions and getting success there for the folks in the state of Minnesota was also a bipartisan or nonpartisan, putting people first effort, and we both agreed wholeheartedly that our goal every day was going to be continuing to do that in this committee. I want to thank the members of this committee for your thoughtful discussion, your respect for one another, and for willing to hear positions that you don't always necessarily agree with, whether that's internally within your caucus or whether that's across the table with persons on the opposite side of the table. This table is in a U shape for a reason. It stands for you, all of you standing up for the people in the state of Minnesota and for the testifiers and for the work that they've done and providing their input. We certainly appreciate that as well and look for another prosperous year in 2026. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you. Chair Herr.
I have nothing further to add, so you all can be let go.
Yeah. Oh, Mr. Chair, I forgot the stars of the show. Our members of nonpartisan staff, Ms. Beckel and Ms. Pomp, we could never, ever do anything without their work and their help. So thank you, both of you, as well.
Yeah, you're here. And with that, no further business before the committee, we are adjourned.